grab your beverages and turn up your interweb. Solving the world's problems 12 ounces at a time. It's Dudes and Beer. Well, hello everybody, and welcome to episode 332 of the Dudes and Beer podcast, brought to you by the HG Universal Network, and me, Chris Jordan, your host, coming at you live from Austin, Texas, still soon to be on the road. I have confirmed gigs, just had one drop, sad, but we'll see, soon to be coming to you from the road, and cannot wait for that. In other news, everybody, please do not forget that we will soon be changing and transmogrifying, so to speak, to transform in a magical way into the curious realm. Dudes and Beer is a fantastic concept. It's a great thing. And someday Dudes and Beer may return in its original format. But the format has grown. The audience has grown. The message has grown and grown to a point that social media can no longer support us, at least by our name. Like, we can't even pay to boost an ad here on Facebook, where we have, you know, great content provided, as well as a great and active community amongst you folks. But it behooves our guests, it behooves our message, it behooves you, our audience, more to move on from the name that launched us and to move into something bigger and better that is more welcoming to all audiences. Some people find the name a little off-putting. It's always been a joke with female guests that, like, well, I guess I'm a dude tonight. So we've heard that. We've answered that. Curious Realm is coming to you very, very soon. While you are online checking that out, folks, make sure to stop on by, of course, the Dudes and Beer website. That is where you can find everything Dudes and Beer related, including the Knowledge Vault. CuriousRealm.com is a page-for-page copy, everything except episode posts of Dudes and Beer. So whenever we're talking declassified documents, stop on by CuriousRealm.com/knowledge and check out the documents. Same ones. My call to action for everybody right now is just Google Curious Realm. Help us out before we even get launched. All you have to do is go Google it, and it will help exponentially. So do it. Have a Googling party. Sit back with the shot and go, let's all take a shot while we Google. And Google Curious Realm. Check it out. This week, while cruising the internet, we came across a bunch of stuff that we have posted into our Dudes and Beer Facebook group. That is where we post all of our news of the week. Stop on by, join us there. That's where the conversation is, folks. Out of astronomy.com, astronomers discover a free-range planet with incredible magnetism. DailyStar.uk, a plane passenger films, quote, shape-shifting UFO hovering 30,000 feet in the air. I mean, the video kind of looks like it's a deflated weather balloon, but that article's there at NPR.org. Capitol police officer testifies to racism he faced during the January 6th riot. Daniel Allen Jones posted out of USA Today. Today, a Harvard professor leading research on existence of UFOs and alien civilizations. Tweakdown.com put out French Navy to test Wall-E laser turret that kills enemy drones. And out of the Daily Sabah.com, new sites discovered around Turkey's ancient marvel, Göbekli Tepe. And I'm sure that some of our guests, possibly even our guest this evening, James Keenan, will have some stuff to say about that. Stop on by once again. Join the group, public group, dudesandbeer.com. That's where you can find all the news of the week, everybody. While you're online checking all that out, make sure to stop on by our sponsors, Podcast Cadet. Here's a quick message from them. Have you considered starting a podcast? Looking for a way to make your business a voice of authority in an industry? then Podcast Cadet is the solution for you. Whether starting a podcast for yourself, your brand, business, school, church, or just plain fun, Podcast Cadet is here to help you navigate the waters of the podcast industry. Specializing in one-on-one consultation and training with industry professionals in fields ranging from podcast technology and editing to distribution, monetization, and even social media strategies, Podcast Cadet tailors their services to the specific needs of you and your podcast. Do you already have a podcast and trying to find ways to engage and grow your audience? Sign up for your Podcast Cadet audit today and let us help you explore new and exciting ways to leverage your content and elevate your podcast brand to whole new levels. From consultational workshops to affordable podcast production and maintenance packages, Podcast Cadet is your one-stop shop for everything podcast-related on the internet. Visit PodcastCadet.com today to sign up for your consultation or training and use code DUDES20 to save 20% off your entire purchase. That website again is PodcastCadet.com. That's right, folks. And while you are online checking out everything at PodcastCadet.com, make sure to stop on by our other sponsor, TrueHim Science. TrueHimScience.com is the website. I'm a user. I was prescribed CBD as a supplemental for my anxiety for travel about 2-3 years ago. And that is when I ran across Christopher Lynch, the owner and creator of True Hemp Science, at a farmer's market here in Austin. I tried some of his product, and I'm here to tell you, folks, I traveled the country. I've been to dispensaries all over the country for recreational things, and I always pick up a little bit of CBD because, once again, it's a recommend from my doctor. True Hemp Science, by far, is the best stuff that I have found. It is fantastic. It's like a warm hug to me. I love my daily CBD dose from True Hemp Science. Stop on by the website today. TrueHempScience.com is the website. Use the code DUDE7. DUDE7 is the code that you want to use to save 7% off your entire cart of $50 or more. And on the way out the door, you will also get two free edibles of 25 grams each. DUDE7 is the code. TrueHempScience.com is the website. Our guests today, James Keenan and Meredith Herrenbrook. We're going to be talking to James first. James is a returning guest. He's been on the show a couple times. Cannot wait to talk to him. James, how have you been doing, my friend?
Hey, Christopher, thanks for having me back on. Doing well, sir.
Absolutely, man. I am ecstatic to have you back because you have finally hit stride, I think, with the investigations that you have been doing out on properties like Blind Frog Ranch and now Skinwalker Ranch in the Uintah Basin area. I know whenever you first came on, actually, it was before even the Blind Frog Ranch show had come out or been considered. Like, I think that they were considering putting the show out. But you've been coming on for a little while with your investigation out in that area and have written a whole series of YA novels. Like, I love them. I've given them to a few friends for their kids. But Bigfoot at Skinwalker Ranch is a great read. Let's start getting into a little bit of your recent research out there in the Uintah Basin area, James.
Sure. So, you know, obviously with the COVID deal, I was shut down pretty much from going to Scotland and Ireland and Mexico, which was my usual. So it allowed me, obviously, to focus more in on northeastern Utah around what's, you know, known as the Uintah Basin, which has two very well famous ranches, Skinwalker Ranch and Blind Frog Ranch. And, you know, coming from that anthropological background that I have and the archaeology, and I think we had discussed this, you know, the last couple times that I had focused really on, you know, the Native American historical data, specifically the petroglyphs chefs that were in the area.
Yeah.
And, you know, getting oral traditions from certain bands or tribes that are located there in the area. As the research and investigation advanced, I obviously realized that what I was seeing in this historical data was being talked about in modern times, taking place on Skinwalker Ranch. And so I delved into that aspect, went down that avenue, and found out that there's not just connectivity with, you know, distant ancient history from the Native Americans, but it drives into the unexplainable from a lot of different aspects. And in order to, I guess, continue being able to properly investigate, I realized that I was going to have to become more technical, meaning get more into the physical archaeology, you know, which requires more of the scientific data collection.
Yeah.
Instead of just looking at it from the social science aspect. And doing that required, you know, upgrading a lot of tech that I had, which meant purchasing different types of magnetometers and gradiometers, ground penetrating radar, upgrading to 3D ground imaging even recently.
Wow.
And it's really amazing because not only am I able to collect or research what I can physically see, you know, with my eyeballs, but also be able to collect data points that would be impossible for me to do without this technology by looking, you know, either into rock or directly into the ground. And it has helped tremendously. It's assisted, you know, both ranches in gathering data that has hopefully led them both to new avenues of investigation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, especially, and I was very, very, I remember I messaged you right after your appearance, your recent appearance on the recent season of Skinwalker Ranch came on, and you were out using a lot of your new equipment, and I was like, yeah, look at him go. Because I remember whenever we first had you on, it was about cataclysms. It was because, like, you've spent years researching cataclysms of the past and ancient civilizations, things like that. And you were just starting to get the material, like you were saying, the equipment to do this kind of stuff. I remember you were talking about the Green Well out at Blind Frog Ranch and some of the readings that you had just gotten with new equipment. So to see you out on Skinwalker Ranch and in this show and putting your research out there and really giving them, as you said, new avenues of research, I was very proud for you, man.
Hey, I appreciate it. Thank you.
Well, go ahead.
It's just interesting because, you know, you brought up the cataclysms and the, you know, those past worldwide catastrophic events. And, you know, you look at what's happening on the Uinta Basin and several theories have, you know, that this location was struck with a large meteor or an asteroid. And as I'm collecting more and more data, it always seems to point towards the potential of adding you know, giants into the aspect of what happened in the past. And are we talking about, you know, underground locations where maybe or possibly not just humans, but other humanoid type species may have ended up having to hang out for a while until things changed? And is this what has become, you know, the sacred areas to the indigenous people and, you know, all the way up until the current Native Americans? And we've just lost that historical data. So there's just so much going on and so many moving pieces that I'm constantly having to alter, you know, the aspects, the avenues that I'm going down, or, you know, the data is just constantly changing. And it makes you, you know, stop and wonder, because you had always heard of so much unexplainable taking place and so many things that couldn't, you know, be followed up on. And until you're actually living it and experiencing it, you know, I didn't think it was for real, but it's 100% legit.
Yeah, and you've been out there for years now doing research, everything else. I've got a topographical map of Uintah up on the screen, but if you look at that, even it is a straight up bowl structure almost. What would look just about like an impact site.
Parabolic. It's very parabolic in shape. Parabolic shape.
And the magnetic anomalies that occur, things like that would, and even the research that was done, I highly tell anybody that watches Skinwalker Ranch, enjoys the research that's going on there, make sure to go watch Blind Frog Ranch. So utterly related is the research that was done on Blind Frog Ranch into the mineralogy, everything else regarding even the strange white substance that turns to metal, things like that out on Blind Frog. It all, like you said, points toward meteoric impact. It's just really, really interesting. And on Skinwalker, some of your research, you were talking about there possibly being a cavity under the ranch, right?
Yeah, so there's tunnel systems, cavern system, voids, cavities, mines, everywhere. It's ridiculous just how much is underground. But I believe at some point in the past, and it may not be true currently, that there was this huge connectivity that they ran for approximately 25 miles, west-east, up in the Uintah Mountains, and then right in the center where there is known ice caves on Mosby Mountain, directly straight down in from north to south, they were connected. And this tunnel system or caverns, it could have been, natural, and then some of it was helped by man, being made out.
Sure.
All the way just past Skinwalker Ranch's property, a little bit further south. And we have found entries into certain, cavern cave systems. And some of these are known, to those that live there. But you're talking huge caverns that go on forever. And you can't go any further because of the large water sumps that are there. And you're talking about maybe 900 to 1500 feet long. Who knows how deep or how wide these sumps are before you get to the next cavern system. And then I wouldn't say nobody. I'm sure the Native Americans in the area have at some point gone farther. But in current time, two divers went to just the next set of caverns and stopped because then the next sump was even looked larger, longer. It was darker, and they just weren't willing to venture in.
Oh, wow. Wow. That's pretty incredible to know that. I mean, and like you said, still actively mapping the underground area within.
Yeah, and you have these, you have what used to be Bottle Hollow Canyon, which was on the reservation, what is now the reservation at Fort Duchesne, which is 3 miles north of Skinwalker Ranch, that became a reservoir. So it was completely filled. Well, as you look through the historical photography, you find these anomalies taking place where it looks like there was some type of subaqueous explosion or some huge release of gas underground that caused these huge vortex-looking ripples in the water. So what does that tell you? Well, there's a void, a cavity where these are coming from. And you go into more unexplainable with it because there's been investigations and potential drownings involving these dark sea serpents that were supposedly in a reservoir. And you're like, well, how the hell could that happen? Well, if you think about it, look at the name Blind Frog Ranch. There were blind frogs living underground in their own ecosystem until, you know, Dwayne Ollinger drilled and they came up.
Yeah.
So what other ecosystems are down there? And most of these are now flooded or there's huge sumps. So why couldn't there be something living down there and now it has access to the reservoir? And when you think about it, look what you're talking about. You're talking about a location that is probably the richest in history when it comes to flora and fauna from prehistoric times. You know, they have Dinosaur National Monument there on the basin. And every location has a dinosaur out front because they're so well known for, you know, what lived there prior to our modern time.
Well, and with that in mind, let's kind of start exploring some of the, I guess, phenomenology and phenomena in the area. You know, I mean, even your recent book, Bigfoot at Skinwalker Ranch, even the whole name Skinwalker itself comes from a phenomena known to the local Indian culture.
Correct. Which one do you want to start out with?
Well, I mean, let's go ahead and start off, I guess, with the concept of the Skinwalker and how that might relate to Bigfoot and Bigfoot sightings and other anomalies going on in the area.
Sure. So the Skinwalkers, what occurred, and this is the history behind it, is the Ute have been in that location longer than the Navajo were. The Navajo are pretty recent to the Southwest. They came down from the North and have been in the area for probably a little over 700, maybe around 800 years. And at some point, supposedly the Ute and the Navajo were at war. The Ute forced the Navajo off of the basin out of Colorado area, the plateau that's there. And the Navajo cursed the Ute with what they call the Yinadlushi. The Yinadlushi are what we know as skinwalkers, and they're considered shapeshifters. The phenomena is that these beings, they're dark forces, medicine men that practice an ancient craft called Adishgash, which is, you know, dark magic, sympathetic magic. And they supposedly were there to, you know, wreak havoc among the Ute. Well, for 100 plus years, you have all these stories and you have a lot of sightings. You have a lot of people talking about having seen individuals morph into, you know, other creatures, whether it be a coyote or a wolf, a bear. And you have this shape-shifting ability among this group. There's also the possibility that through this, you have other cryptids that may very well play a part into shape-shifting. So, and you know, you get this from two different perspectives. One, some people believe them to be completely separate. Others believe that they could be one and the same, just having that ability to, you know, morph into a humanoid, not just a human or, you know, some other animal.
Sure.
And it's interesting that all of the sightings of both, not just Bigfoot or the Yinadlushi, with being the skinwalkers, but they seem tied to this area on and around Skinwalker Ranch, including the mesa. There's a large mesa above it, and that's where Skinwalker Ridge is located. And you have the Native Americans, you know, talking about this being land, used to be tribal land that they don't go on for these specific reasons. So it's really interesting to see that when you're talking about Skinwalker Ranch or the Uinta Basin, we're not talking about a single phenomenon occurring. We're talking about multiple phenomena. And
over generations.
Over generations. And you have to wonder, is there something there causing the phenomena, or is it that the phenomena is attracted to what's there? You know, is it, you know, coming inward or outward towards the basin, which there's many different theories as to what the possibility or the potential is for that. And, you know, that's what they're investigating right now. And it was investigated secretively for years since, you know, the early 1990s, and nothing was released to the public.
Yeah.
So it's just pretty dang neat that, you know, Brandon Fugel and those involved with the ranch have been a lot more open, forthcoming, and have allowed the public to
go along
as best they can with the investigating that's taking place.
Well, and, you know, I think that's a huge part of it. I think especially in the end of season one, whenever they were bringing in people from the state, and they were thanking folks, because I think this is a phenomenon that's not just happening over the ranch. It's happening over the region. And if this is something that, be it radioactive material from a comet or a meteorite or any kind of interstellar impact, something like that, people need to be made aware. You know, is it a health concern, or are the gamma ray spikes that they see a health concern to the surrounding area? And I think that that's, like you said, a big part of Brandon Fugel being as open as he is about the research going on. I think that, unfortunately, not that the research that Robert Bigelow and Bigelow Aerospace did for decades out there wasn't good, but it's all under wraps. We have no idea. We have a few stories that have leaked out, a few people that have said some things that were possibly there, that were there maybe. But aside from that, it's not like they're actively putting things out to the public, you know?
Remember when it was NIDS, they weren't government contracted, so they were able to share more. And that was where Hunt for the, you know, Skinwalker, the book came from, was those years with NIDS. However, when it became BASS, they were government contracted. And as you and I know, and I understand, if there's a lot of NDAs that go along with that, and, you know, the government doesn't want certain things disclosed, and if they're paying for it, you stick to it.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's unfortunate for me. It's unfortunate for you and the rest of the public.
Ask any researcher that goes to Los Alamos with their work.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that's kind of the price that you pay for having that door of financing open to you, is that nobody's going to find out about your work.
Yep. It doesn't belong to you.
Yeah. Well, and let's get into that for just a minute, because once again, this property and the area and the research surrounding it have changed hands so many times. Has this been a situation that, at least that you know of, where Brandon Fugel has talked to people from BAS, has talked to people from NIDS? Have they been forthcoming with any information as far as sharing back and forth?
So if you follow along with the individuals that are attached to the ranch, they come right out and say that they know as much as we do about that, that Bigelow was unable to share anything. And, you know, they're having to reinvent the wheel when it comes to what's taking place on the ranch. And, you know, I believe them. I know a couple of people Yeah, I know a couple of the individuals from NIDS and from the Bass team. And, you know, some of them didn't know everything. It was a need to know for a lot of the scientific data that was being collected. A lot of people were left in the dark, even those that worked for Robert Bigelow at the time.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And I think that that's something that a lot of people don't really, because you know, you run in the same, a lot of the same online communities that I do, James. And there are a lot of people of very conspiratorial mind, let's just say. And that's not to say that, hey, yeah, when once those alphabet agencies become part of financing, once again, you're locked down. You aren't going to be able to say a lot of things, but even what has been found right now with the work going on presently, to see the fact that they are being watched by something, by someone, somebody's keeping an eye on what's going on. It's pretty hard not to get conspiratorial about some of it. and the unfortunately, some in the community tend to get a little upset when all you're doing is trying to present some science. When you're just, cause I mean, that's of course what we want to do, right? Is use science to prove the phenomenology of what's going on. I mean, that's the whole reason why they brought people like Travis in and stuff like that. Is to be able to come at it from as scientific a basis as possible. But even still, some of the things that have happened, even on the TV show, I cannot imagine what footage is not on the TV show, what things have not been revealed, you know, because like I've been in production. Right. I know what hits an editing room floor. Like, dude, entire albums hit an editing room floor before you get 9 songs on tape. You know what I mean? So, yeah, I can't imagine the things that are not used in production or that they are like, hey, let's kind of keep this under wraps until we know more. Or that even people have come up and said, hey, you're keeping that under wraps, right? because, yeah, alphabet agencies have been involved out there. They may not be now. Full on, but they have been.
Sure. And, you know, a couple good points you made that I just want to add to is you got to remember that for one episode of Secret of Skinwalker Ranch is not even an hour long. It's
42 minutes
plus. Yeah. And then you have all these additional commercials. So in order to shoot that amount of time, it could take days, if not weeks, for, you know, one episode. And then there's all this editing that takes place. And the poor guys from Prometheus, you know, they have to figure out what to show.
Yeah.
From all this data collected in this tiny amount of time. And then people get upset because they didn't go back and follow up on this or follow up on that. Well, that would take forever. I mean, it would never make it to television. Yep. It would be a 60-hour episode.
Yeah.
And people would be bored out of their mind watching the data. If you watched me collect data points with my magnetometers, you would fall asleep. You'd be like, this sucks. I'm leaving. It's boring. There's times I have to walk away and just do anything else and put the damn machine down because I get bored out of my mind collecting this and writing it down and having to, you know, go from the magnetometer to the GPS back to the laptop or to the tablet. You know, it's tedious work.
Yeah.
And if you really wanted to see that, you'd shoot yourself in the head before because it's crazy amount of time to collect this data. And what people don't realize is Eric Bard, who is the lead investigator that was hired by Brandon and is there on the ranch. He's a physicist.
Yeah.
You know, a physicist. He's not, you know, just somebody that Brandon hired to come be on the show.
Yeah, he's not like teaching chemistry at the local community college or something.
Right. And he's collecting a ton of data, a ton of information, doing his own research. And that's going into this, you know, huge pot of what they eventually hope probably to release. They're never going to, I don't think they're ever going to be able to, you know, I guess say what, find the smoking gun of what the energy is or how it works. But at some point, I believe that they'll release the data in a scientific research report that will benefit other people to then carry on from what was given to them into, you know, different aspects, go down different roads with their specialties.
Yeah.
And hopefully at some time in the future, figure it out. But it's going to be a collective. It's going to be a lot of people having to add to the pot after Eric and the team are done with the initial information and research that's taking place.
Absolutely. And I, once again, I think that's something that a lot of people do not realize, is that even Travis going out there, like just production of that, like he has to set aside 2 or 3 months. The stuff that's shot with him is only a couple few months at hand. Eric's out there researching 24/7 to gather enough to be like, hey, when you're out here for this couple months, let's look at A, B, C, and D, you know. And let's focus on that. And then it's during that time that everything is produced as a show, that people like you come out and do your research at the same time and then go independently, call that data, and then send it into them, you know. And even once again, the data that you called while you were there was absolutely phenomenal, man. Let's start going into some of that real quick. And some of the different possible things that it might mean or implicate for the phenomena that are happening out there.
Sure. So, again, it was on just 2 episodes, on episode 6 and 7. So remember that what you see is a minuscule little piece of the data collection. And then even being out there was a small amount of me collecting data. This, my data collection took a couple years of being able to gather all of this and then analyze it over and over again and use different software. So initially I had, out of hundreds of data points, these 3 locations. One was south of the ranch and 2 were directly north of the ranch on the mesa. And they were magnetometer readings that showed differences in microtesla. And the magnetometer is just a tool to read the magnetic field at a specific location on the planet down to the core. And that's what the, you know, the magnetic capability of that location is, and not capability, but what it is at that point. So on these 3 points, I had these transient reads where it was going from a negative 14 microtesla all the way up to a 50 microtesla in a location. The basin, it averages at about a 48.
Yeah.
That area around there is about a 48 to 50. So how the hell am I getting negative 14 microtesla, and it's shooting up and down, and the only way that this should be occurring, or that I should get a negative read, is I am either in South America taking these readings, or there is something massive like a huge magnet underneath me that is causing this interference and this continuous movement of the monitoring system of the magnetometer. So I find these 3 points, and lo and behold, after I punch it into GPS, it comes out to all 3 of them are at the exact 8.34 degree heading. Well, that shouldn't be possible? Over, you know, I've been all over the basin and done this for miles, and right in the middle, like it had shown, was Skinwalker Ranch, and it had run through this area of just high events, other events taking place. So like you had seen then on the show, once we were there again, right in that same diagonal line, right on what they call the triangle, is this spot that's now going anywhere. I think it was between a 31 and a 49 micro Tesla. That shouldn't be occurring again. And what that leads me to believe is that there is some type of underground system, void, cavity, tunnels, caverns, whatever it is, running along that location. And in order for there to be this transient magnetic change, magnetic energy change, there's something there, whether it be through water that's, you know, has all the right chemistry coming, you know, like it's pretty saline, which underground, yeah, it has a decent saline. It's positive. It's got positive ions, and it can carry the charge more.
Yeah.
Or if there's some type of metal railings or a mine system.
Sure. A vein of copper.
You have to stop and think. Yeah. Iron, you know, the magnetometers are picking up ferrous material. So what could be doing this? And then what people don't understand is when there's a negative read below the average field, that means that there's an opening or a space. So when the guys came in behind me with the drone that had a magnetometer, and you're seeing this software, I have 3D ground imaging that does the same, but it's a local, like it's not as large as that was able to show. These soft colors, these blues, are showing locations below ground that have a lesser mineral content, meaning it's not there, meaning a void.
Yeah. Yeah. A change in density at that point. And
So what's there? Because this goes along with the Native American stories and oral traditions of Karshinab and the god Toats and what the LDS, the Mormons, came across back in the mid-1800s with a guy named Morley and another guy named Rhodes and Chief Wakara of the Utes. And you have to start then going into the research and piecing things together from, you know, this church's history, the oral traditions that I collect from people at Fort Duchesne or in other locations. And then you have to meet with the locals, especially those who had family members that own the ranch, and you start slowly piecing things together and you're like, wow, you know, this matches up with that. So then it goes with the scientific data that we just collected, and it's incredible the picture it starts to create. And man, I just get so excited from you know, getting a piece of this and that, and then being able to put it to scientific data and prove that, you know, what's going on or what I think is going on is going on. And then to be able to enter some of these caves and know I was right. Man, that's just, you know, it's topping on top.
That's awesome, man. Because once again, kudos to you on everything that you have done to get to this point with your research, period. And then to have your research verified in so many ways is absolutely fantastic. Let's revisit for a minute, because you just mentioned a couple of local tales, a couple of things, the LDS experiences that our audience may not be aware of. Let's start getting into a little bit of that local culture that talks about the subterranean, that talks about things like that going on. Because I mean, of course, like a limestone void with water running through it will absolutely create electric fields, all kinds of stuff, you know. But even going into the stories that you were just talking about, a lot of people may not be aware of those stories of subterranean culture, that kind of stuff. So let's get into that for a minute, because I think it's really interesting to go into that oral history that exists and explore what ancient cultures thought whenever they were occupying the area. And even not even ancient. I mean, not like the LDS movement going out into that area is ancient in any way, shape, or form, you know? I mean, heck, that's just beyond our grandparents, man. You know?
Right.
that's nowhere near ancient. That's just slightly before the power grid, folks. So let's go ahead and get into a few of those stories so that people can really make that connection. A lot of people may not be aware of these things.
Sure. First thing, when I'm giving my presentations at the conferences and things of that nature, I like to let people know that you have to remember that the Ute are speaking what's called a Uto-Aztecan language. They have connectivity to Mesoamerican culture. And from the data that I've collected, I'm almost 100% sure that those people that we know as the Aztec and lived in Tenochtitlan, which is present-day Mexico City, well, yeah. Guess what? They started out more than likely in the Utah area, more than likely a good part of them in the Uinta Basin. And that in and of itself is amazing, because then you go, oh, man, well, that's where the Hohokam, the Mogollon disappeared to. They were absorbed as these people walked south, and only a few were left. And people go, well, where did these cultures go? Well, they went southward. And I can show you the loss of these cultures as these groups moved from Utah downward until around 1300, when they finally started organizing and creating these republics and became known as the Aztec, because really the Aztec didn't exist. They were a bunch of bands and tribes and groups that formed a confederacy there to create the Aztec. But so you got to think, well, we have all these oral tradition from Native Americans that these groups of humanoids or other species saved their ancestors from a major catastrophic event, like the ant people with the Hopi, that took them below ground. And as they were underground in the underworld, they were taught how to survive once they were to go back up on this now arid desert land. And there's all these traditions of there being these underground cultures and civilizations right after a catastrophic event. So that's something you first got to keep in the back of your mind. So now we'll move forward into history, and we have the Spaniards come and conquer the Mesoamericans, and then they move upward, northwards. They come to the Ute, and they're like, hey, we're interested in this yellow ore, this yellow metal. And the Ute tell them, oh, well, yeah, we have a ton of it. There's already mines in the area, and there's even some that has been smelted and is already turned into bullion. And you're like, the Spaniards will probably, how the hell is that possible? Who was here before? Because the Native Americans didn't do that.
Yeah.
So they start collecting this bullion and they start mining. They enslave the Native Americans. And the Native Americans are like, oh, man, now they have these oral traditions of this is occurring again. We used to have these giants that were called the Starnak that were miners, and they were located all throughout the world. They had mining tools that made sound, meaning it had to have been electric, pneumatic, or vibrational. And now you're like, well, we have these group that shouldn't exist, these giants here even before the Native Americans. So you have the Spaniards there. Then the Mexicans come. The Mexicans are in Utah, and they're going into these underground systems. They're mining. They're finding other caches. Then the Mormons come in the 1840s, and a Morley and a Rhodes, I don't remember their first names. Those are their last names. Befriend Chief Wakara, who is one of the chiefs of the bands or tribes that will eventually become the Ute. And as we know them, the Ute, as we know them, I think they were called the Nootch. That's what they call themselves, which are the people. I think it's N-O-O-T-C-H. And I apologize if I spelt that wrong, but they called themselves the Nootch. And Chief Wakara tells them that you don't need to mine gold. There's tons of gold already available. And so suddenly the LDS that were pretty poor, they didn't have a lot of money, suddenly are building all these temples. They brought in, I think it was 600,000 converts into the Utah territory. And you got to ask yourself, well, how did that occur? And people say, oh, it was by those that went to the gold fields in California. Well, most of them were recalled right away by the prophet Brigham Young. So that was impossible. And Rhodes, he had the most gold, and it was only several hundred ounces. So that's no way they could have ever done what they did. But then Brigham Young is first telling Morley, and then Morley tells him he can no longer do it. It turns over to Rhodes, and then Rhodes' son, Caleb Rhodes, eventually. But they go on these 17 to 21 day treks from the Wasatch Valley, where they're living, to the Uinta Basin. And they come back within 17 to 21 days with all this gold. Well, that's impossible. You can't mine and smelt gold and travel on burros and horses with that amount that quickly. Well, then when you conduct assays on the gold that was in the Mormon gold coins and the Spanish bullions that used to go to Santa Fe in Mexico, well, guess what? The bullion is about identical. It's around 90, 91, maybe 92% purity. So it's not pure, it's bullion. So you're like, well, what the hell is happening? Well, you dig deeper into these stories and you find out that there's a possibility that there was this huge asteroid or meteor strike a long time ago. And someone went below ground to survive it. And they went into what seemed to be this huge metal nugget, like gold. It was gold or whatever. And if they were living down there for a long amount of time, you know, population expands, you have to pull that ore out and place it elsewhere. So you have this cash mine.
Yeah.
Now, fast forward to today. Well, those ancestors survived something. And this place known as Karshanab, it's not a mine. It's a location where the ancestors were that's sacred and guarded by Toats, which is God. But there's this second location where there is this cache of gold that's already in bullion. So now let's put it into Skinwalker Ranch and Blind Frog Ranch terms.
Yes.
All of a sudden we have this possible ancient technology below ground, living site underground, mines, connectivity. At Blind Frog Ranch, you have Dwayne Ollinger that has gotten maps done by satellite that show the cavern systems and mines under his property that are unfortunately now flooded that weren't in the past. But what Dwayne is looking for isn't ore. It's not gold, or he's looking for that bullion. And there still has to be a lot of it. And then you have one last story to add into it, Chris. And that's when there was 1 year that the Spaniards were pushed out of Tenochtitlan. And that gave the Aztecs 1 year to hide their treasures. Well, people think that it was locally just in Mexico, maybe a little further northward in Mexico. But if you go deeper into the oral tradition, they broke it up into seven locations. And the main location was Origen for them. Well, guess where Origen is? It's Utah. And that's where the main cache. So there's now this possibility that a large portion of that Aztec treasure that was hidden from the Spaniards, I think it was between 1519 and 1520, is also located up in Utah somewhere.
Yeah.
And so you have just all this oral history and mythology and folklore and church history all coming together. And there's so many moving parts. And you just got to wonder, you know, what else are you going to throw into the pot?
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, people ask me all the time why I believe in, because I mean, like, I'm a believer, heart of hearts believer, James, in Bigfoot, UFOs, things like that. Never experienced. I've had what might be like, I guess, technically a UFO experience. It wasn't identified, but it wasn't like lights in the sky that I saw, things like that. I've definitely had my own religious experience and paranormal experiences. But despite my belief, despite my urge to believe wholeheartedly, lies inside of me the skeptic, and it has to. Like, it has to exist there. I have to be able to question, you know. If I questioned the norm that was given to me as a kid religiously, and that's what led me down my spiritual path, I can't not question even what I believe now. You know? Like, that logic escapes me. And when people ask me why I believe what I believe, I tell them, it's not through my personal experience, but it's through the experience in the oral history of cultures across the world. And I refuse to call them idiots. Not when they have been proven to be right so many times.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like, I mean... You have a written history that was literally written by the winner. They have an oral history that says that they lost, and they lost hard. Which one you want to believe?
Right.
So, and when you go into these oral histories, when you start getting into these oral histories of the local cultures, like you're talking about, the ant people who saved the Hopi. Stuff like that, especially right there in the Four Corners area. It's so wild, the stories that happen that are so universal about there being a culture of people underground. Even whenever you get into the giants that chased Native Americans and supposedly cannibalized them. Things like that.
You have, you know, a lot of history on the Cite Ka, which were the redheaded cannibal giants. And I think we even talked about that I went in April and spent 3.5 days researching in Reno, Nevada, John T. Reed's 91 boxes, including five or six boxes that were restricted.
Oh, wow.
It took me a while to be able to gain access to some, but he was an avocational archaeologist. By vocation, he was a mining engineer, and the man collected so much proof that the Giants exist that there's no way that I can deny their existence. And then when I see the petroglyphs of the Fremont culture, the Barrier Canyon style culture, you know, their petroglyphs match what was said by the Nuragic people in Sardinia, which were a Bronze Age culture that were 5,000-6,000 years ago. They look the same. Sardinia and the Uinta Basin are on the exact same line of latitude.
Yep.
Their symbols of the upsilon are the same for the giant. When you look at the giant petroglyphs at McConkie Ranch, which is also Dry Fork Canyon, they have 6 digits on their fingers, but they have these huge feet to show that they were big in stature. And you know, it goes into the other, you know, if you look at the Bible just as a history book, you know, look at Rapha and Rapha's people, you know, Goliath was, I don't know if he was I can't remember if he was a son or a grandson, but he originated from Rapha. And it's just nuts to not believe that they didn't exist throughout the world. And then you got to ask yourself, well, how did they do that? The locations they were in tend to show this history that there were portals. So not only were they seafaring around the world, but maybe they were using technology that has been lost to us. And when you're on the Uinta Basin, sometimes you run into some strange phenomena that occurs. I talked about it on one of the episodes, and now I'm able to discuss it. Was I had a standard compass, you know, a Boy Scout mm-hmm. compass, and it was spinning in both directions, which it shouldn't be doing. And what didn't make it on there, what I've discussed in my presentations and all that, was there's this humming noise, like a vibration or this frequency that you can hear when this is occurring.
Wow.
At least when it occurred to me around Dry Fork Canyon in the back end of it, and then up on the north end of the mesa. So there has to be some type of energy that changes something or alters, it shifts.
Yeah.
And what its capabilities are, we don't know yet. But, you know, you think about it, we're solid. Rock is solid. But if you vibrate it enough, it can, you know, separate. It can turn into, into you know, a different state of matter.
Liquefaction can occur.
Yeah. Why can't there be technology that was far greater than ours in the past that we've just lost that knowledge? And hopefully we will learn how to use it again, or find the instruction manual, I always like to say, you know, buried somewhere in order to turn it back on and use it.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, with that in mind, like, even here recently, to bring it back to the Giants, there was the discovery of Dragon Man in China. I don't know if you saw that, but this like, changes the timeline of humanity entirely. This has been a verified find. This is not anything hoaxed or anything like that, but they're talking about a totally separate lineage and something talking about people being taller than your average bear and the skull being of a larger capacity than your average bear. To quote the article from BBC News, quote, "The skull is huge compared with the average skulls belonging to other human species. Its brain was comparable in size to those from our species. Dragon Man had large, almost square eye sockets, thick brow ridges, and a wide mouth and oversized teeth." But this is all of like a month ago, not even June 25th. That article came out in BBC and numerous other outlets, and we covered it here right after we had L.A. Marzulli on talking about Giants. And as a redhead, I have vested interest in this story. Because, I mean, not a lot of people know, but like if you're a redhead, you can literally trace yourself and your lineage straight back to the first redheaded individual, which was in the Middle Eastern, like Turkey area. You know, when you're talking about Nephilim and giants and redheaded giants and things like that, and the fact that there are the giant caves in Turkey and there are caves in here in America, and like there's just so much that crosses paths, James. And once again, it's hard not to get conspiratorial, but at the same time, there is so much fact amongst all of this.
Sure. Yeah. There's, and everybody, like you said, conspiracies come up, pop up a lot, but you also have to remember that the museums or these warehouses where a lot of past archaeological excavations were sent, they're big places. And unfortunately, yeah, you know, people retire or pass away, and what was stored in a, you know, an old spot in the museum in the basement was forgotten about. A lot of times they'll remodel and they accidentally close off a room that, you know, may have housed who knows what. And there's a lot that's lost, and it's not intentional, but it's unfortunate that it's happened in such a small amount of time. So my point that I'm trying to get to is, now consider what we have lost historically when you're talking about having to go back 1,000 years. Mm-hmm. And then 2,000 years, and then 5,000 and 10,000 years. So how are we allowed to call ourselves expert and say we know everything and that it can't be any other way, when we can't even keep track of the last 100 years,
yep,
of our findings and research? And well, it's easy to put blame elsewhere, but we also have to look at, you know, it's accidental, and time in and of itself is a beast to fight against, especially when you throw in things like, you know, catastrophes occurring or wars and other things of that nature, yeah, or things just being destroyed.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And even just the loss of the narrative of a culture, once again, those cultures that tell the stories about the redheaded people from the subterranean worlds cannibalizing them in the Four Corners area, that kind of stuff, those people still tell stories. The survivors and the ancestors that are still alive still tell these stories and keep it alive. The question is, you know, 100 years from now, is the data in the hard drive that I'm holding in my hand right now going to be legible? Are people going to know how to get it out of there? I mean, right now, we got a generation of people that don't even know what the heck an 8-track tape is, James.
you know what I mean? My son came across a 5 1/4-inch floppy disk that I had in a box. And he was like, what is this? And I said,
that's about half a document, son.
Yeah. And he's like, well, how do you use this? And I said, well, you have to find an old computer and just slide it right in and hope it's still working to be able to read it.
Yeah. And then deal with the ungodly sound that sounds like it's destroying your piece of cellophane. I remember I helped a friend boot one on a few years ago, and it was like, wow, that's frightening sounding. Did it always sound like that? I can't even remember. I mean, well, we were so normalized.
But
I mean, that's just it. I mean, I'm 45. I had an Atari 2600. I had an 8-bit gaming machine. And to know that now I am holding a 500 gigabyte drive in my hand, and it is a wafer. It's literally the size of a piece of, like, chewing gum out of a Topps baseball package when I was a kid, you know? That's just mind-blowing. But once again, the question comes to bear, what's going to happen in 100 years? Like, do you have the technology to recover the data off of that 5.5-inch floppy?
Not at all.
You know? No. Could be the secrets of the universe on there. Who knows? Think about that, too.
Like what you're saying, think about it. So maybe there was all this historical data or way of retaining it. Think about all the books and codices that the Spaniards burned in Mesoamerica. We lost all that history. But what if there was prior cultures and civilizations of distant historical times that had other ways of keeping their data, and that was lost, destroyed? Or maybe, you know, maybe the governments have found it. Maybe it was on some type of crystal or something, and we have no idea how to read it, like you said.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. Because, I mean, that research has definitely been done. Like, you can store data on quartz. It's a thing. It is absolutely possible. So to think that ancient civilizations may have had some way to do that, may have had some way to interface with that natural technology in some way that we don't, is not a mind-numbing concept, really, to think about. And when you're talking once again about hundreds and hundreds of years, in some cases, thousands of years of oral tradition, I'm more akin to believe that oral tradition about something such as Sasquatch, strange energies, portals even. That's straight up what was shown in the petroglyphs that you were talking about, the Fremont petroglyphs. So to know that that's the same thing that people from Bigelow Aerospace said that they saw happen at Skinwalker Ranch. I do not find it a far reach. I do not find it that hard to imagine. And especially if you're talking about a huge magnetic source such as maybe an iron meteorite, something like that, along with the iridium and other rare minerals that could come along with that, you could definitely be looking at some incredible amplification of what would normally be natural phenomena, which once again, like, it blows some, like, put some copper wire around a pipe and run some water through it and put a voltmeter on it. Running water itself carries a current, you know? So when you're talking about it going through limestone, when you're talking about it going through limestone connected to something like a huge iron meteorite that would create something the size of the Uintah Basin that I have on screen, you could definitely see how that could be a natural amplifier, so to speak.
Sure. Yeah. And, you know, this area is just, full of so many other things, because you can even consider that ancient Eocene Lake Uinta was there.
Mm.
And this lake was massive. I mean, it covered parts of Colorado and Utah. And if something impacted in that, it would have assisted in covering it up.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. Now, we have you for about another 15 minutes. Before we let you go, let's start getting into A, how have things been going with Bigfoot at Skinwalker Ranch?
Yeah, it's been going well. It was the book number 3 in the series, The UFO and an Alien. Yep. And, you know, what I wanted to do was, the original book was to introduce kids about ages 9 to 14 to ufology. I did it fictionally because I also wanted to tell a story and explain, you know, equality and equity by using the alien. But I wanted them to not just understand terminology, but to be able to live it through the eyes of someone their age.
Mm.
And then I had the main character move from what was right next to Peterson Air Force Base over to the Uinta Basin. And instead of now dealing with ufology, I wanted to deal with cryptids and with the shapeshifters and Native American oral tradition. And I wanted to do that through the eyes of, you know, the same age group between 9, 10, and 14. So I put a lot of thought into the third book. I wanted it to still be around Skinwalker Ranch, because I incorporated some things that I wasn't allowed to discuss into the fiction. Hint, hint, if you read the book number 2 and 3. So there's even something there for the adults. But I felt that it was a good way to pass on to generations that are a lot younger than I am, that you are, you know, things that I find interesting, and that hopefully we can, you know, bond with those age groups. And my other concern is, when you go to a conference, a UFO conference, you know, the average age is, I'm going to tell you, it's probably about 60, 65 yep. years of age.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was going to say, it's a 50, 55 plus
and investigators. Event. Yeah. Are we going to lose the next generation of researchers and investigators? You know, when it goes into the paranormal, the younger age groups seem to really enjoy that more. They like to watch that on television. But they've gotten caught in this paradigm where they're using technology to gain data that they have no idea what they're gaining. They read, oh, I have a 23.4, you know, and it's jumping up to this.
Sorry, I had to throw the applause in there for you, man. I have been preaching that for years. James, years. Like I'm sorry, I did some paranormal investigation with people. Good God, man, I got a Geiger counter over my shoulder right now. to see somebody who has no idea what an EMF field is to begin with, trying to use a Gaussian meter, or you know, the phenomenology of what's going on site should not bear into your research at all. You should never be looking at things on site. You should never be evaluating data on site. You are coloring the experience at that point. Like there are so many things, even the whole concept of EVPs. Like, I love you folks with the digital recorders, but that's a one and zero interpretation of the audio going on around you actively. There is nothing electromagnetic about that at all. So if the ghost is supposed to be manipulating an electromagnetic field to put the voice on. I guess they figured out how to do that with ones and zeros, you know, as opposed to like a magnetic field, a weak magnetic field of a record head that they were supposed to be recording. There are just so many things like that. Where it's like,
yeah,
that's just not sound science. I'm sorry. You can't just like flip the script on what you decided the ghost was doing because of the technology in your hand and the artifact that you're finding.
Or if you, so you capture something, well, what are you going to do with that now? Why don't you, and there are some people that now they attempt to, figure out what it's not or what it is.
Sure.
And they rule things out, but you're still stopping at the only point that you know that you've watched on television, and you're not asking the right questions. And I, you know, I spent 24 years as a criminal investigator or in private investigations, and that's just the beginning. You have to start asking the big questions.
Yeah.
After that point. Well, and there's a lot that I don't know. You have to go out and find the answer, and it's not going to happen right away. You know, I may have not known something, and then 2-3 weeks later, I'm like, it just pops in my head. I'm like, oh my gosh, you know, let's run with this avenue or attempt to look it up in this way. And it's time consuming. It's not going to happen right away. And you have to continue it to some end point and try to figure out what it is that you're really trying to do.
Yeah. Yeah. And and you got to be willing to look at things in a skeptical mindset, James, even when you're in the heat of the moment, you gotta be willing to dismiss it. You know, you gotta be willing to explain that by all explainable means before you jump to the extraordinary. And like, my God, man, if they were actively finding paranormal evidence the way that they do in those shows, every single show, it would be science, man. There would be no question. You know what, yeah. I mean? Like, even once again, the amount of footage that goes into shooting one of those things, even the fact of one thing being caught per 30, 40 hours of recording, that would be extraordinary. And
sure. And
so like it, the phenomenology would already be proven by the evidence at hand, where it actual evidence is the issue.
Exactly.
Because it seems like they find something every show. And that's honestly one of the things that I love about not only the Blind Frog series, but the Skinwalker series, is that, they are willing to question what they find. They are willing to say, we have no earthly idea what this is, but they have scientists there. They have actual people who know how to read dosimeters, how to read, background radiation, things like that. So it's a different realm of data gathering, so to speak, than your average weekend warrior out there with an EVP meter or with a you know, EVP machine and a EMF meter.
Exactly.
Well, James, I want to thank you so much. Before we let you go, we got you for about another 5 minutes. Let's get into the exciting new things that you are getting into. Let's talk about this phenomenal Phenomicon coming up that you were a part of. I'm so excited to hear that you were a part of that event.
Yeah. So it's the first ever Phenomicon in Vernal, Utah. It's taking place September 9th through the 11th. So it's Thursday, Friday, and Saturday. What it is the Secret of Skinwalker Ranch and Mystery Blind Frog Ranch have gotten together, and they are going to be putting on presentations. There are going to be add-on trips to the front of Skinwalker Ranch, courtesy of Thomas Winterton. So he'll take them right up to the gate. Not inside, you know, obviously there's a lot of concern in regards to radiation and all that, but he'll take them to locations where he can show them certain points. You'll be able to spend time to ask him a ton of questions. And the same is going to be with Blind Frog Ranch, Dwayne Ollinger and some of the other people connected to the show are going to be taking groups on to Blind Frog Ranch. You're actually going to get to go onto the ranch. Which should be fantastic. And there's going to be other things where you can share your experiences. There'll be dinners with, I think there's dinners with Travis Taylor, George Knapp, and is it Jeremy Corbell Locke? They'll be speaking after myself and Eric Bard. And I think you can, there's add-ons for having lunch with them. And there'll be a panel for the Skinwalker Ranch group for us to discuss, you know, during the course of that. And then the following week, September 17th through the 19th at the LAX Hilton at the Los Angeles Airport is going to be the Conscious Life Expo. And I am going to be talking about ancient secrets and earth mysteries with Caroline Corey and William Henry. So that should just be great in and of itself as well. And again, that's September the 17th through the 19th at the LAX Hilton.
That's awesome. Yeah, as I was telling you before show, I have followed the work of Caroline Corey for years and years and years. And to see her finally coming into the light that her work deserves is amazing. And to see you out there sharing the stage with good folks like her does my heart good, James, because it means, it means to me that your research that you've spent so many years on is now coming to the eyes that it needs to come to. It's now getting in front of the eyes that it needs to come to get the attention that it needs. I think that you've done some extraordinarily important research when it comes to the Uinta Basin, Blind Frog Ranch, Skinwalker Ranch, and even as we were discussing, which we need to have you on again about the concept of giants in the area and the underground civilizations. Just that is once again a conversation in and of itself. And we just barely scratched the surface of that tonight.
Absolutely. And remember, too, that all this, for me at least, started out in Mesoamerica. A lot of my research and investigation took place in Mexico, Central America. And there's so much going on there. And I'm going to incorporate a lot of that into my presentation, too, especially dealing with the lost city of Xihuacan on the west coast of Mexico. So I really want to promote that, so people, you know that there are complete cities that are still have yet to be excavated where there is a lot of unexplainable occurrences taking place at.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, quite honestly, because of the technology of things like what you have, LIDAR on drones, things like that, entire temple complexes and unheard of civilizations being found in the jungles of Mexico and beyond. Even things like this new find near Göbekli Tepe, you know, the entire time frame of humanity, as we showed with Dragon Man a minute ago, is shifting. And has to shift. And if it doesn't shift, we are at fault. we are at fault for not being open-minded enough to make that change and to say that the timelines that we have are wrong and that the ones that these ancient cultures have had for years are probably a whole lot more dead on than we are ready to admit.
I agree completely.
Well, James, once again, thank you as always for coming on the show. I can't wait to see what comes next out of you. I've thoroughly enjoyed Bigfoot at Skinwalker Ranch, as well as your other stuff, Shapeshifter Scare, all of it. And folks, if you want to find out more, go register for Phenomicon. Check out his panel there. If you want to find out more, go check out the Conscious Life Expo. Is that it?
Yes.
Ha-ha! There you have it.
You got it.
James, thank you so much, man. I'll be in touch very soon. Take care, and we'll talk to you soon, man.
Hey, thanks again. Take care. Have a good night.
All right. Bye-bye. While we shift gears real quick, you know, it's been interesting to make this dive into the world of people like James and the research that he does in ancient civilizations, the research that he does into all kinds of topics such as that. So right now, talking about ancient civilizations, we're going to be getting into the concept of family soul constellations and ancient civilizations encroaching on mankind, so to speak, when you're talking about ghosts. And not only that, but how our manifestation in the world changes things, with the author of Becoming Ridiculously Awesome, Meredith Herrenbrock, will be joining us here in just a moment, right after this message from our sponsor, Podcast Cadet. Have you considered starting a podcast? Looking for a way to make your business a voice of authority in an industry? Then Podcast Cadet is the solution for you. Whether starting a podcast for yourself, your brand, business, school, church, or just plain fun, Podcast Cadet is here to help you navigate the waters of the podcast industry. Specializing in one-on-one consultation and training with industry professionals in fields ranging from podcast technology and editing to distribution, monetization, and even social media strategies, Podcast Cadet tailors their services to the specific needs of you and your podcast. Do you already have a podcast and trying to find ways to engage and grow your audience? Sign up for your Podcast Cadet audit today and let us help you explore new and exciting ways to leverage your content and elevate your podcast brand to whole new levels. From consultation workshops to affordable podcast production and maintenance packages, Podcast Cadet is your one-stop shop for everything podcast-related on the internet. Visit PodcastCadet.com today to sign up for your consultation or training and use code DUDES20 to save 20% off your entire purchase. That website again is PodcastCadet.com. That's right, folks. Stop on by Podcast Cadet today. Full disclosure, I am one of the founders of Podcast Cadet. And the whole reason I started that was I love this field of podcasting. I come from the world of live TV, broadcast, corporate AV, things like that. And I saw so many friends with businesses trying to do podcasts that were struggling, that did not know how to do social media, how to get that message out there, how to really switch that gear in your head, so to speak, that it takes to do. And our guest right now, Meredith Herrenbrock, is somebody who talks about exactly that. We will be getting into the world of neurolinguistic programming. We will be getting into the concept of manifestation through that, and how those things lead to the possibility of ghosts, So welcome to the program, Meredith. How are you today?
Well, thank you. I'm doing really well. How about yourself?
I'm doing fantastic. I am extraordinarily excited about this conversation.
Well, good. What's your first question? What is your burning question?
Honestly, probably the first question that most people would have, especially my audience here, because I've covered the concept of NLP with other audiences on other podcasts I have. And it's an interesting switch, and it's something that I had people for years. I had an old boss and mentor of mine ask me, like, damn it, Waldo, how the hell can you turn everything into something positive? Like, all the time, you can find something positive about it. Like, somebody could come and kick your dog in the face, and you'd probably find something positive about it. And I was like, honestly, it's a switch that I have to flip on in my head every morning. Otherwise, I could go into some really dour and horrible places knowing what humanity is. But it's the fact of, it is a switch that we flip on in our head to be either negative or positive. And it's a decision that we make when we wake up in the morning. And it's literally a part of that NLP, that neuro-linguistic programming that we give ourselves, that, like, you know, I'm just no good at technology. Is it the fact that you're no good at technology, or that you haven't realized the fact that, like, you're 65 and you didn't grow up with this thing in your hand? Give yourself a break, you know? So let's start getting into who you are, what you do over at your websites, not only with your book and your website, Living Your Awesome, but also how that relates to ghost-free property. Because, like I said, I think a lot of us are kind of pulling that self-fulfilling prophecy thing. And perhaps through some of our language and the way that we mentally deal with the tragedy in our life, are creating the ghosts in our own property.
Ooh, that's a good one.
Thank you.
And yes, we will touch on that. Goodness, so where do I start? That's a big, broad question, but I'm going to start, and then just help me direct, you know, help me figure out the line here.
Well, let's start with NLP and how that deals with manifestation. Because I believe that's the root of what deals to the other side of that question is, are we manifesting these things by proxy? You know, are we like trapping our relatives by hanging on? Oh,
goodness. Yes and yes. So there are a few. I'm like, whoa, these are good questions. And thank you so much, Chris. So the thing is, NLP, I think, is a really good springboard for people to begin to understand that they are manifesting everything they think and believe and do and create. Okay. That we are not the victims of circumstance.
Yes.
And that's a hard one for a lot of people to believe, because I think when we're little, you know, we are growing up, we're learning we are in a certain circumstance, which we may love or not love so much. It could be totally horrible. And we go, how the heck did I get here? You know, why am I here? How is this even possible, etc.? And so I think we're raised to kind of not really understand the power that we have. And we just kind of bumble along and survive and do the best we can. Right?
And
so what happens then is, then we turn, you know, 18 or 21 or around there, and then finally we're given the golden keys to the kingdom, and we go, see, now you're an adult. Now you have to create this whole world. You have to go forth and prosper. And I think it's a really hard switch, because as a society, we don't really like to give the manifesting tools until people are older, because it's hard to raise kids. It's very hard. The kids challenge you and everything else. And so then you go, but I need to control. I need to figure out my household. I need to work. I need to deal with all my things, right? So there are lots of layers of why these so many children are not born learning. Hey, you're a little manifester. You're a master manifester. So what you think and believe and do creates your world. And so then we grow up thinking that we're powerless. And then when finally the world is not how we want it to be, and we keep bumping our heads against the wall, we go, well, but why isn't it working?
Yeah.
So there are these conflicts that are happening. And so NLP is just a beautiful format to start you getting in touch with who you are, that what you were thinking and believing when you were younger is basically now echoing throughout your lifetime until you decide to believe and think something different. Because what you believe and you recreate, what you survive, you recreate. And so when you start to understand that, and it takes a little while to go, wait, I have power. That's hard for people.
Yeah.
To think that, wow, they might have power, not just getting their shoes on and stuff, but it's like, but if I think something different and not just I'm going to hope for something, I'm going to wish for something outside myself, enter religion in some ways. Sure. And that's another power grab too, to be honest.
Hey.
Yeah. Hey, in some ways, hey, there's a lot of great things in religions. I am not knocking it. There are great things, but there's a fine line with the aspects, the true deeper aspects of religions that I think really benefit society. Talk about truth and honesty and high level, high energy stuff versus, well, we just want to control the masses and we just, you know, it's so forth and so on. Okay, so again, there's this other layer of all the society putting pressure on you of you are powerless. Okay, so what do we do with now that maybe we can believe that we can create our world? That takes a while to reconcile, but it's possible because you're doing it all the time already. You just don't know what you're telling yourself. Does that make sense?
Sure, sure. I mean, and you know, granted, I spent years teaching religion, spirituality to junior high school students. I myself was a Roman Catholic seminarian my first year in college. Mm-hmm. And even now, I am 90% spiritual, maybe 10% religious. I firmly understand those people that are religious. They have my heart. I'm with you. I do not discount what anybody believes. I say it all the time. Half the reason I started this show was so that people had a place to say what they believed. I mean, I myself was moved to the seminary because I felt the presence of what I know to be God pulling me and asking me to go serve. Now, that was not the way that he wanted me to serve. Cool. It was kind of like, hey, thanks for playing, Johnny. What are his parting gifts? But I went and played. I listened. And that was the important thing, whether it was that construct that we know as religion now or my spirituality and my connection with God beyond that building and people, you know. But I think it's hard for a lot of people to make that distinction. Meredith, I think it can be hard for a lot of people to separate the religion and their spirituality. And I got that from my spiritual director in the seminary, who was a Cistercian monk, who was the one who told me, like, religion's a great thing when taken in moderation, Chris. Like, this is a monk.
Yes.
So, and it gave me that mentality of, like, Don't be my favorite thing you used to tell me was like, so how's that working out for you?
Such a great question.
Of course, he was my spiritual director, so he was like my therapist, quote, but spiritually. And he heard a lot of the same problems come up, and he went, well, how's that working out for you? Just as straight as you could be. Because, yeah, sometimes you need that hard truth. And it's hard, I think, for a lot of people to recognize that. And it's hard, I think, for a lot of people to recognize the place of the hard universal truth beyond themselves.
I agree with you. It is very hard. And if the word I use is clunky, when you start to, when you start to kind of go down the path of really questioning the deep questions, not the, what am I going to have for breakfast, but the existential, who am I? What is my place? What does life mean? All those things. You know what, when your soul is ready to listen, the universe will offer it in very subtle ways, and you have to learn to listen to what that is.
Yeah.
It's a very high, for me, it's a very high refined vibration, and you know, you have to be quiet. You have to stop listening to all the stuff in your head. And so, so what, here's what I think NLP does really beautifully is it starts to get you to also separate the what have I been told versus what I know to be true.
Yeah.
And it's, it, it allows a lot of introspection. Look, my truth may not be your truth, but if I'm not harming anyone and I feel that this is the path I need to take, then that's the path I need to take. If it works out, great. If it doesn't, well, maybe it was, there was a lesson in there needed to happen to get to the next part. You know, the journey is not going to be shown to you on just one big map. It's one little thing at a time, but it starts off clunky when you have learned to listen to everybody but yourself. And in my book, which is called Becoming Ridiculously Awesome, Who Doesn't Want That? I talk about following the ribbon of light. And I remember when I started asking questions of myself and the universe and cursing everybody and going, why am I here, et cetera. But when I finally stopped yelling, I go, there would be just like this little, these little synchronicities, these little coincidences that just seemed almost too good to be true or too easy. But I go, but why is it seemingly too easy? Why can't I have that? And the more I started to notice what it felt like and looked like, that the things that were really good for me, that was just right. You know, when there's something that just feels resoundingly right for you, that there's no other question, then okay, you do that. And then you start to notice how that feels. And then you start to filter differently and look at the world differently. And as you think and feel and believe a little differently, a little bit more elevated, well, what happens? Then the universe will show you more of that vibration. And then you'll go, oh, I'm starting to get it now. And then there's this play, this dance that happens that has always been happening, but now you're recognizing it.
Yeah. And that's a beautiful way to put it, because the when I taught ninth graders, the one thing that I would always do, the first class, I would give everybody a slinky and just have them say, we would talk the whole class until like the last 5 minutes. And the slinky was on the desk. There's the potentiality for all kinds of fun. Like it rolls downstairs, goes over in pairs. You know, all kinds of things. We're going to have all kinds of fun with it. That's the potentiality, you see. But when you put the slinky in both of your hands and just sit there, it doesn't slink one bit. It takes you actively pushing the slinky for the potentiality of the slinky to be realized. And now you can have all kinds of fun with the slinky. You just have to realize that you have to push the slinky. You have to actively do something to activate the universe. You can't just sit there and wait for the universe to passively do something for you.
Very, very true. Very true. And, you know, there was a time where I used to think, well, why do we have a body? Right. What is the purpose of this whole tangible object? And I finally, kind of more recently, in the last few years, go, well, without a body, you can't create action the same way.
Yeah.
And you can't feel things. You can't feel the density. You can't have objectivity the same way. And it's important to have that, to learn the lessons, to experience and all those things. But it's a beautiful example that you gave with the slinky of you Thank have you. To participate.
Yeah.
Yes. You have to create, and then it will act and react and play with you.
It's like going, man, I wish I could win the lottery. Did you buy a ticket? Because that kind of helps. Like, you got to play the game, you know? You got to put something into it. There is no zero-point return energy. It does not exist. We've proven that in physics. You can get all kinds of infinite return out of something that you push into. And you can get greater return out of what you put into it, but you gotta put something into it. There's no zero point. And that's just physics. So, and I think, you know, like we kind of said in the beginning, a lot of people get caught up in, and I guess that fantasy that, good things are just supposed to happen for them. What does it take to activate that switch mentally? Because I think that's what a lot of NLP is in my research, in the guests that I've had in other shows. It really is that learning to activate yourself to be ready to receive.
Yes, not only receive, but also realize the power of who you are fully and wholly. Because, you know, I was just working with someone the other day, and, you know, I started to think, well, why is this person not feeling that she can know what her life's purpose is, which is a big question. And I go, well, all right. And I go, well, when someone feels small and not confident or lacking, or, you know, having these shoulds and, or I can'ts and all those, all that mental baggage that we stop ourselves. And there's this beautiful NLP question of what stops you from having that? You know, and we start off with, well, what would you like? And even that question can scare the bejesus out of somebody, because sometimes they've never been asked that. They didn't even know that they have value to even be asked that question.
Yeah, a possibility to have what they might want.
Exactly. And then we go, well, now that we have the conversation of that you exist and that you have the right to need something and to want something, then, well, what stops you? And that's where the societal pressures, all the family rules, all the judgments and all the baggage from the past come into play, because all those rules got you to here and now, and you made the best choices that you had a long time ago. And what happens with the brain is when you make that best choice and it worked, then you're going to apply it again, because why learn 20 billion different new ways of doing something if one already worked? So, but then as you grow up, it gets outdated. So we need to update the system. But the main question of why we don't touch that slinky, why we don't participate, is it's something that we fear. Yep. We fear judgment from people. We feel that we are going to lose something of value. Like, maybe I'll lose $20. If you want to play in the stock market, you go, but I could lose money. Yes, you could. Well, then just You could, but you could also gain things. So, you know, but the starting questions are, what do you fear? What stops you from making that choice to actually play the game and be present in your world, in your life, and making those actions? Everyone says, oh, you have to do these things. I hate that, to be honest, Chris.
Amen.
I hate it.
I do not have an amen button, but I do have an applause button.
Hey! Thank you.
Because it's true.
The action is the last thing you should be thinking about.
Yep.
It's the mental stuff. It's the belief stuff. It's all of that internal workings. The action is just the result.
Yes.
That's just the end all, the pièce de résistance, you know, and but everyone says you need to do these things to make this happen. It's like, no.
No.
What are the beliefs and all the things that are stopping you? Because then once you believe that you can and want to, et cetera, and it's really well formulated, then you're naturally going to want to do it. Your body cannot help but want to create happiness for yourself.
Yes. And
here's the thing. Yes.
Go ahead. No, please go ahead.
I have to add this, and it's super important. We always want happiness, right? So then the next question is probably going to be, but then why am I doing all these things that make me so unhappy? The thing is, if you survive something, you got a reward for making that choice, and the reward is that you survived it. So you get this hit of adrenaline, like, yay, I survived it.
Yeah.
And yay, there's a victory. But it's old programming that is just outdated and needs to be updated. So the thing is, you're getting a reward. You're miserable now, but it worked then. And so anyway, the thing is, we're giving our system and our brain too many things to do, going in too many directions, trying to make everybody else happy. And we tend to be the last people to make ourselves happy.
Yeah.
Because we don't understand what we're telling ourselves. Make sense?
Well, it's, and I'll add to the fact of not just understanding what we're telling ourselves, but it's not understanding why we need to be happy. And why, because there's this part of the human brain that is reptilian, and the amygdala and things like that, that's been programmed through fear for thousands of years. And it's what's kept us alive. It's a great thing. Don't get me wrong. Your fear is founded, people. There's a reason why fear, like I try to explain to my wife that I will never laugh at a valid fear from my son. Ever. My son's 4 years old. He's asleep in the next room. I will never, ever laugh at a valid fear from my son, because you can't rationalize fear. Fear in and of itself is psychologically irrational. I'm afraid of heights. I am up in a 35 foot lift or on a 30 foot ladder regularly to put projectors in the air for events, things like that. Am I afraid? Like 15 feet up the ladder, I start breaking a sweat. Yeah, I am like petrified inside. Petrified. But it's something that I have to move past in order to do my job, you know. Ask any police officer, are they afraid when they go punch their time card to walk out on the street in the evening? Yeah, they're afraid. But is it something that they move past, or is it something that petrifies them and stops them from moving? And I honestly, Meredith, am somebody who at one point in my life was the stymied person. I was the person that when that barrier came to me and that moment of action came, I chose inaction. It took me years to break the programming of what if I fail. It took me years to break that. And now I'm like, I don't care. If I have an idea, I ask my wife. I just launch it. She'll come home and I'll be like, yeah, so about a .com today. Like, I don't even care anymore. Because my failure and my success is defined by me and my parameters. World be damned. Family be damned. I really don't care. Are you doing this? Because I am. Show me where you're doing that, and then I'll call you successful. How about that? And that's where I had to come to be a success in my world was the point of, like, hey, all you people that said, like, when you're done playing with wires, are you going to find a real job? No, I get played to play, go around and play with people's expensive toys. You know, like,
right.
Sorry.
It's all perspective.
I kind of made it happen. And it's possible. And a lot of people don't realize that living your life via your passion, doing that and finding a way to make that marketable and make that happen is absolutely possible. And that's a lot of what you're teaching through NLP and your book and your website, livingouraawesome.com.
That is what I do. I help people get unstuck from their many phobias, PTSDs, anxieties, bad dreams, you know, keeping out of relationships, all of those things. And the thing is that what I would really love to address with you on what you said a few minutes ago is that certain fears are irrational. And I really want to counter that.
Okay.
Because on one hand, yes, as you were talking about the reptilian brain, you know, you have the fight or flight response.
Yes.
Okay. And again, what you survived, you kind of recreate. So if you froze previously and it worked, you're probably going to try that again. Sure. Until it doesn't work. Mm-hmm. The thing that I have learned with, and I have two little girls as well, and they're afraid of spiders and all these things. And I go, the question that I often ask in my head is, well, where did she learn that? Did she learn from someone else? Is she modeling it?
Yeah.
Is, you know, and so forth and so on. And a lot of phobias or beliefs are installed because we watch somebody else have that reaction.
Oh, sure.
And if we see someone have that reaction and go, well, if they're, you know, an adult and they're someone I know and respect, well, if they're having that reaction, maybe I should have that reaction too.
Sure.
And so with the more I've learned from my clients and working with them is there's always at least one, probably often like five or six choices and decisions and beliefs and experiences that that person has had that has solidified that fear. But we have so many experiences each day, it's pretty darn hard to keep track of it.
Yeah.
And also, little kids don't have really long-term memory for the first few years, so it becomes more instinctual. And so you just go, all right, well, let's just go, what's the impression you have of when you were 3 years old or 2 years old? And they go, I can't really remember. You're like, but was that feeling still there? You know, and you go, oh yeah, it still was. And then you find out the imprint. And so the imprint is what we call kind of that first time we had that choice, that feeling, that experience that made that future echo happen. And what we do is we go, well, and we unpack that. We go, well, what were you thinking and feeling and doing and who was there? So we can kind of create the picture. And then we go, all right, so what did you believe about yourself in the world? And they go, oh, well, you know, and they'll come back with a blanket statement. And I go, all right, well, great. But so say it's someone who is afraid of spiders. Okay. And that was my phobia, until I went through NLP. And so I finally realized that I decided to be afraid of spiders because my mom was petrified of spiders. And there's this time where she's on the bed and dancing around and, oh, you know, kind of freaking out. And I decided because I trust, you know, of course I trust my caregivers, my parents, and they are caring for me. And there's kind of a massive assumption a blanket belief of, well, if they're wrong in any sense of the word, then that might mean that they're potentially wrong elsewhere.
Yeah.
And if that is possible, then that means no good for me growing up.
Yeah, that's so threatening to a paradigm psychologically.
Absolutely. So you have to kind of do this suspension of belief and just go, everything my parents do until probably teenage years is correct and right.
Yeah.
And so her phobia became my phobia, but it was a decision instantaneously. And so you end up unpacking phobias and fears and beliefs, whatever they are, from relationships to, you know, always sabotaging yourself from getting a wage increase, or from sabotaging yourself from traveling all over the world, you know, whatever it is, big or small.
Yeah.
There's been a decision that's happened. And so we unpack it. We go, what stops you? You know, and what do we need to have all these beliefs in place? It's so forth and so on. So, but I don't think anything is irrational anymore. From what I have learned, it always goes to a root cause of either mental, emotional, family systems, or entity related. And well, that's why I do all three.
Granted, when I say irrational, I mean the fact of, have fun explaining it to somebody else. Not everybody, you know what I mean? Like,
I can't
explain to somebody who I'm working with, who's on the other side of the ladder, like 10 feet up, why I start breaking a sweat. And they're like, dude, we're like right under the AC vent. What's wrong with you? And I'm like, we're like 15 feet off the ground. Yeah, I know. We're going to 32. Shut up, dude.
Right.
Like, that's what I mean by irrational. The fact that that can be rooted to something in my childhood or in my life, like literally my first memory, Meredith, is seeing what I know, at least like inside of me, to be what I know to be the devil out near a swing set outside of the trailer house that I lived in. That is my first vivid memory in my life. Not even joking. So to talk about what you're talking about and how that memory as a child may have carried forward to my life, may have carried forward even to some of the fears that I hold today inside.
Absolutely. Not even a question.
Yeah. No, not even in doubt, not whatsoever. So, and you know, once again, it took me years to break that NLP of other people and the definition of other people's success. And the fact that because I wasn't doing what other people had expectation of me to do, that I wasn't a success. And I think that that married with a lot of people's religious preconception. Like, I remember the day that I had a talk with a later spiritual director. And this was when I finally started just having an issue with the church. Because everything else I could put aside, explain away. Hey, humans are humans, what have you. But the day that my spiritual director told me that the church does not have a teaching on the paranormal or ghosts or entities.
Even though they do exorcisms.
And I was like, exactly. I was like, I own a copy of the Rite of Exorcism, dude. Like, don't ask me to believe in the undefinable and the intangible and then tell me that it's not here. Like, right. I can't even, like, the leap of logic for that was so huge for me, Meredith, that was the straw. That was the straw. At that point, I was like, I can't even.
The inconsistent quality is crazy.
Yeah.
I agree.
And that's when it was like, I will, like, my heart of hearts is with them, all that good stuff, but I am 98% spiritual and I have no need to go into a building to prove my connection with God, to prove the existence of ghosts, entities, demons, angels, any of that. No need for a physical building or magistrate to tell me so. And I think that that is what kind of moves us into the next segment of what you do, because at some point in your life, let's get into how you started studying Huna healing, because I believe that branch in your life, and of course that branch of what you do, has a lot to do with ghostfreeproperty.com and the other facet of what you do, as far as and what I was saying at the beginning of the show is, as far as I think a lot of people are manifesting their own issue through that familial soul constellation concept, you know, and through the idea that, like, my son's name is Dalbus. And he's named after my grandfather, who's probably the most near and dear person in my entire life. Probably the only person that, like, got me. And there are so many behaviors that I see that are straight up my grandfather. And he's 4 years old.
Yep.
Like, he even walks around calling everybody kids. What's going on, kids? How y'all doing?
Oh, it's like,
he's four, dude. He's four. Who are you calling kid? but things like that. And I think that ancient cultures, other faiths, adopt this concept regularly. And the idea that these souls, so to speak, are within a family, and that they exist, they embody multiple people, and that they move forward, and that, you know, sometimes when they aren't supposed to move around, they're supposed to move past, we kind of keep them here through our sorrow and our grief, and they're literally here, like, because they love us unendingly. But are we keeping them here?
Sometimes we do. I don't know if necessarily we have the power to force anyone to stay here who doesn't want to be here.
Sure.
Right? Everyone has free will, and that is a universal truth, is we always have free will.
Absolutely.
And we always have a right to have one soul per body. And so when I started studying Huna, I was also doing NLP, but I had started studying Huna because I'm very intuitive. And I was, when I was little, I started having premonitions where I would dream about things that would happen 6 months later.
Yep.
And so when the experience happened 6 months later, I would go, wait a minute, I dreamt of this. And I go, that was like 6 months ago or so. And it was interesting. And it happened for big events, happy events, sad events. And it got, as I got older, especially in high school, like I literally could follow conversations with people. And my sense of time and location got very confused, because I'm like, well, am I in the premonition now? Or am I actually in real time? It was really bizarre. But anyway, so I had these questions on, why are these premonitions happening? How is it possible? How can I be here yet see something in another time? So that led me to questions about space and time and souls and everything else. So when I finally found a teacher where I looked at him and I go, okay, that's going to be my next teacher. I don't know quite when, but that's it. And I ended up studying with him over the course of 2 years, learning about the Hawaiian spiritual-based healing system called Huna. And it's a very beautiful and gentle overall way of healing. And it's also very similar to NLP in regards to you go to the root cause of what is holding you stuck or hurt or having entities attached and so forth. So we're always looking at the root cause of something. And so, you know, if someone gets hurt, they don't go, oh, what happened? They go, why did you get hurt? So there's this choice. There's this understanding that you are co-creating your whole experience. And maybe it's subconscious and maybe it's from past life stuff. Maybe it's from entities that are attached to you and they have their baggage, you know? So if maybe an entity was a smoker, now maybe you become a smoker. Maybe that, you know, there's a client I had where they kept dreaming, or this person kept dreaming of a White House, and she just never knew why. It made no sense. And, when we did a Huna session, where you put a person under gentle hypnosis and you ask non-leading questions and you kind of uncover what's going on. And the stories are varied. They're just all different. And, anyway, so this woman, we figured out that there was an entity attached to her who had died. And it was his dream of his death. And it was the dream of not only his death, he was the last one to die, but it was the dream of his family's death. And so I got downloaded into my vision the whole scene. So I had to relive this whole thing on basically... you know, a man who had basically escaped from prison. It was like somewhere in the South. And this family was, you know, on this beautiful lush farm in this little valley. And there was a creek running by, and I mean, it was just idyllic. And so he hears, so the father hears something in the house and he goes in and he sees this man in this suit, you know, kind of the old prison suits, you know, take out his family. It was awful. But here's the thing, not to just tell you a gory story, though I know people love ghost stories. The thing is, once we did the work and I told this man that he was dead and that his family was in the light and so forth, and I helped him along, I helped him reconcile his pain. And then I said, well, do you want to be here any longer? Do you need to be here any longer? And, you know, he said no. And my, you know, client said, I'm ready for this person to go. And so there was a meeting of the minds, if you will. So I kind of act like a facilitator, negotiator sort of thing to keep peace for everybody. And once peace has been reached, then they'll go. And then my client no longer had the dream of the White House.
Wow.
Yeah.
And you know, once again, how frequent is it that it is the client finding their peace with the situation that allows the spirit to leave? Like how, because of course you've got your website, Ghost Free Property, things like that. How often is it that somebody moves into a property and there is something attached to the property? Or how often is it, or conversely, what are the odds that somebody has dragged something to the property with them?
It happens all the time. All the time. And here's the thing. It's not necessarily that there are entities attached to every home.
No.
So entities
attached to every person.
Which often is actually true. And I will say that entities are also just thought forms, not necessarily a soul, you know, of some being somewhere. But what I've learned is that, you know, I don't know, I've cleared a bunch of houses and properties this year, and one property had negative energy attached to a vase. and this vase was a gift to the woman of the house from the place where she worked, and she hated everybody there. It yep. was a miserable place, and they gave her a going away present. It was this plant and this little vase and everything else. And I went into this room, and I go, what is here? And it felt heavy. So I pick up on sounds. I pick up on voices occasionally. I feel things mostly. And often I'll get images, and I kind of get the full gamut. And so I just go, why is this room so heavy? And I keep scanning the bookcases and scanning. I keep looking at this vase. I go, it's a little vase with footprints on it, you know? It's like almost like a baby shower. And I go,
sure.
But I keep my attention keeps getting pulled there, and something or someone is telling me that's it. So then I ask the lady of the house, and she goes, funny you should say that. And I go, I just smile when I hear that, because I go, I'm on the right track. And so she tells me the story about where she worked and so forth. And I go, so why are you having a vase that's constantly reminding you of something that caused negativity? Yeah. Get it out of here.
Yeah.
And so she goes, all right. So I'm like, so are you able to let this go now? She goes, yeah, I never really liked the vase. It gives bad memories. I go, so let's see, let's move it out, and then let's see if I feel any difference. And of course I immediately did. And that's what happens for me, is when I go to a home, I will get pulled in directions. I will ask about certain items. It could be jewelry. It could be, secondhand toys. That has happened a few times. You know, it can be all sorts of things. So I would always caution everybody, if you're going to give a gift that was previously owned, bless it, clear it, send yes. it love, and keep it neutral. And yeah. you can do a Ho'oponopono prayer, but you literally shift the energy of that object.
Yeah.
Because that energy, however big or small, gets imbued into your objects, into your house, into your property,
yep.
into everything. And you have to constantly do some spring cleaning. Spring cleaning is not just cleaning the stuff out of your closet. You are putting your positive intentions, resetting everything, and, you know, and have a party at the end. But you need to constantly check in on your energy, and you will feel so much better at home. So well, much better. So imagine a year of COVID and all the energy you've got.
Oh, God. We have had literal episodes about that whole concept, Meredith, yeah. because, yeah, I mean, I love my wife. I love my wife, Meredith, like a lot. But she's tired of my face, man. Like, yeah. I spent 35 weeks a year on the road doing AV. I have invaded her world
yes.
over the last year and a half. You know? There is an understandable angst. There is that builds up. And yeah, like we have to be very careful. I've spent the better last half of my life studying world religion, philosophy, things like that. And the one concept that comes up more than anything is the concept of the golem and the egregore. And those are magical concepts of either something that we imbue a will into, an object that we have imbued something into, a will, a wish, a want, a fantasy, what have you, or something that we as a society have subconsciously manifested because of a yes. unique fear that we share.
Yes.
And I think so many people are woefully uninformed about these concepts. And it's really something to kind of like, it to me keeps me on the heels of my responsibility, like mentally,
Yes.
And where I have to be, like, I can't let that negativity rule me. Yes, there are horrible things happening. I cannot let that negativity rule my thought, my thought process, my decision process, the way I interact with people. It's so important not to let that rule. And I think that is so much of literally the way of Huna, is to figure out that energy construct in which you live and keep that sacred.
Absolutely. And I think what I love about Huna is that it is very gentle and subtle energy, but very powerful when it needs to be. But the underlying structure is this understanding that you are a powerful light being, if you will, that you have to take care of your house. You have to take care of what you're saying to yourself, what you're thinking, and so forth. But it sounds that you have studied and you have looked in that mirror for enough times to really go deep and really understand yourself to a level such that when you get a pebble in your shoe, you might grumble, but you know that you can take the pebble out. Okay. Yeah. You know that. And I love that you are shining your light and sharing all this information with people to help them. Because the thing is, a lot of people are so inundated with just surviving and just dealing day to day.
Yeah. It's hard.
And it's so hard. But here's the thing is, once you start to lighten the load, and you do, you know, an NLP session or a Huna session, or, you know, sit under the tree for 5 hours and work on one problem, right? And let that down. Then what's going to happen? Then when you start to let those things go, you're going to become lighter. You're going to become more focused. All that negative energy will not be able to have a hold on you anymore. And you can direct yourself in the one direction that you want to go. So there's some cleanup that happens, but when you get to a point, then you go, let's play. Now, even if there's a pebble in my shoe, I know how to handle it. I'm not going to bowl over and cry and, you know, throw a 3-year-old temper tantrum. It's like, it's a pebble. I can handle this. Yeah. Or if I don't know how to get the pebble out, then I know where to go. I know how to ask the questions, you know, or I know that at just the right time, there will be some synchronistic event where it will just, you know, move on its way. You know what I mean? But then there's play and there's the masterful actions. But right now, so many people, especially with COVID, were being told all these things. And I think a lot of them are lies. That we just get back to center. And if you don't know what your center is, just turn off the TV, turn off all those things and go talk to yourself and go, what do I think? Tell everybody else to shut the hell up and just think for yourself and get in touch with kind of your highest self. Because there's a lot that he or she wants to say.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And that's something that we discuss on the show all the time, is that concept of we are the ones that manifest our reality. We are the ones that give kind of that whole Freddy Krueger concept. Like we give power to that negative energy.
Absolutely.
And if we can rein in control of that, if we can rein in control of that negative or even tribalistic thought of us versus them, even within ourselves, then we can help somebody else understand that. We can help society move forward in that way. But we got to be willing to recognize that it's there in ourselves, and we got to be willing to move past it within ourselves first. You know?
Yes. And there's a beautiful phrase, if I could say, is whatever it is in me that created this in you, please forgive me. I love you. You know, I thank you. And you do the Ho'opono prayer. But it's whatever it is in me that created this in you. It's like that yin yang concept of, you know, without me, that can't necessarily happen. It's like, what is it in your body, your vibration, that is resonating for that to occur in your experience?
Yeah, because again, that's something that, my God, I'm going to use that turn of phrase from this point on in my life, Meredith, because it resonates so much with me, and something that I have tried to express in so many moments in life of what is it that I have done to help create this conundrum?
Mm-hmm.
What is it that I have done to help create this miscommunication emotionally, spiritually, this turbulence between us, what have you? And it really is that owning of action. You know, we've spoken with so many people on this show about that Kabbalistic concept of us being uniquely breathed into and partaking in that creation through, because we were spoken into being, we speak things into being. You know, like as a guy, I could go up and punch somebody in the gut and laugh and go, ha ha, got you, dude. But let me say something about your mother. Let me say something about your wife. And see how that resonates. See what that creates. Even the shift of mentality and the rift that it can create mentally and spiritually between two people because of the cleave of the words that you said and how you said them.
Yes.
Could have meant nothing to you, meant the world to them. You have now spoken that into being. So what responsibility do you bear in that situation? And to take ownership of that, I think psychologically and emotionally and spiritually is a huge forthcoming step. So I'm all about that turn of phrase. Now, before we let you go here in just a minute, let's get into how this gets into what you do with ghosts and clearing property. And like we were saying at the beginning, how frequently is it that our attachment to somebody keeps them from possibly moving forward, moving on, that kind of thing?
Well, when someone dies, sometimes they know they're dead, sometimes they don't know they're dead. Depends on the experience. Sometimes they don't want to go, or they're angry that they are dead, or that they really want to help someone here. And so here's how souls attach to someone or something, is that there is a kind of an energetic match. You know, if you have two guitar strings that are hitting the same, you know, C
harmonic,
it's a harmonic, exactly. And when you have that, then there's an energetic match. Often it's of sorrow or fear, anything less than, you know, love and happiness. But when someone is feeling that, a soul out there or an entity, if you will go, oh my goodness, I recognize that feeling and I want to help that person. I want them to, you know, I want to take away their pain or whatever. And so there's this, I recognize that, and it is instantaneous where they just link up.
Almost a sense of responsibility.
Sometimes, and they want to help. But then instantaneously, then they don't know they're separate, and then they go, well, I can't get out of here. I don't know how to get out of here. And now I'm in this body. And so what do I do? So that, entities cannot attach to you if you do not basically have a little hole energetically in your system. So you have to constantly scan and go, what are my fears? And, you know, and so forth and so on. And there's, I always check in, you know, I always check in with myself probably daily and go, all right, am I feeling good? Am I feeling myself? Am I hearing voices that are not mine? And I'll go, you know, and I'll do my thing. So anyway, ancestors, to answer your questions, they can't stick around if they really aren't in consciously or unconsciously invited. But how you know they are here is, as I have experienced with clients, is because you cry whenever you think of them, even if it's be, you know, 2, 3, 10 years beyond their passing, is when you are constantly thinking about them, you cannot let go. Well, it's because they haven't gone and they are attached to you. And once they do go, you will have tears. You will kind of have sadness when you think of them, but you are not sobbing. You are not constantly preoccupied with their existence. And that's how I have learned to know when ancestors are attached or not.
Mm. Yeah. And I mean, I, of course, know a couple people in my life who have probably held on to some emotions a little too long. And that's not saying that they're keeping anybody from moving on or anything like that. But what are they doing to necessarily keep themselves from, I guess, finding and riding that proper wave? And what are they doing to possibly open themselves to attachment by familiar entity?
I think it just happens so fast. Again, we're not trained in this Western society to even consider a lot of these things. We don't know what entities feel like. No, I mean, we don't even know how many entities we have attached to us right now.
Yeah.
You know, and I'll tell you, the first time I was learning about entities, and actually right before, there were so many voices in my head, literally, and I had lived with them my entire life. So I just thought they were different aspects of me and so forth and so on. But there was one day, it was just so loud in my head. And I just mentally just screamed and just like, shut up. And then it was absolutely silent. And I go, wait a minute. And I heard me in my head, you
know, was an option.
And I go, but where are these other what the heck? And I go, wait a minute. Are these me or not me? And that was the first time I realized that, wow, all these voices in my head were not necessarily me. And when I cleared them out, you know, through the process of learning and taking the classes and so forth, I go, oh my goodness. And when I finally, it was just me in my head and just in my space, I was blown away. Yeah. So my question is, how many people have all these voices or all these experiences? They have no idea that they have another option or another experience of just them running their own ship.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And you know, once again, a lot of that does come to the realization that you have the power to have control over that.
You do. You absolutely do. And doesn't mean you need to be mean or kick them to the curb in the harsh way, but just say, I've got this. Thank you so much. You may go now.
Yeah. Absolutely. Because it can be hard to not to want to surrender yourself to such a feeling, such a sensation. And it can be heart crushing when surrendering yourself to that does not work out for your life necessarily.
I never really think that it's a good idea to have an entity as a pet. You know, on one hand, it feels like, wow, there's someone who understands me, or
someone
there's a connection. You feel more, right? Gets me, and I feel important. But the thing, right? I mean, there's a little bit of ego that kind of happens. Yeah. But what happens, though, is you're kind of bogged down with their baggage and you can't really live up to your full potential. So yeah. You've got to live your life alone, but does not mean you're lonely, does not mean you can't have them visit you or give you advice or meditate and see them in a field or whatever. Like, there are so many options that just because they're not in your space doesn't mean you can't ever see them tomorrow. Or in your dreams or anything like that.
Yeah.
Again, it's, you know, you can be alone and powerful, but not lonely.
Yeah. And I think that that's hugely important that you bring up the fact that you can manifest that connection anytime you like.
Absolutely.
You can manifest that connection anytime you like. You do not have to keep that bridge open to the detriment of you.
Yes. And if you are, then I go, well, why?
Yeah.
Why do you want to make yourself miserable and less than what you were created here to do?
Yeah.
Whatever that is.
Man, absolutely. And that is only part of how you become ridiculously awesome, Meredith. Only part.
Yes. The only part.
And there's so much that you have going on and that you offer as not only a consultant, but as somebody coming out to vibrantly and vibrationally clear things. Before we let you go here, let everybody know where they can go, of course, other than the dudesandbeer.com store, where they can go to get your book, where they can go to book you for counseling, where they can go to have you come vibrationally clear property, things like that.
All right. So please go to my website. It's livingyouraawesome.com. You can buy my book there and I will inscribe it and send it to you the next day. You can also get it on Amazon and you can also, there's a Kindle version. My sessions are based about every 3 to 4 weeks. And the first session is free where we have a consultation and we map things out. We see if we're a good fit and then we move from there. And so I have a 4-session offering right now because it is very complete and it takes about 3 or so months where you get an entity clearing, NLP session, family soul constellation session, and so forth, whatever is needed. So we tailor it to you. And if you find some ghosts in your attic or have some heebie-jeebies at your office, you can go to ghostfreeproperty.com. I can clear it remotely. There's no such thing as, or there's no such place as far away. And so those are how you can get in touch with me. And you can always email me, meredith@livingyouraawesome.com. I would love to hear from you and ask all the questions you want.
Fantastic. Thank you so much once again for taking your time. Please do hold the line, Meredith, while we close things out here. While you are online checking out everything from Meredith Herrenbruch, make sure to stop on by the Dudes and Beer podcast. dudesandbeer.com is the website. Make sure to stop on by our sister website, the all-new curiousrealm.com. That is where you can find everything that is upcoming. We will be coming there in December. Eventually, my internet will click to that. Anyway, until next time, everybody, take care of yourselves. There it is. Curious Realm. Until next time, everybody, take care of yourselves, take care of each other, and remember, if you can't be good at it. We'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye. Dang.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Dudes and Beer Podcast. To listen to our audio streams or chat with us live, download the official Dudes and Beer app for Android and iDevices, available on Google Play and iTunes markets. For more episodes, content, and information, visit us online at dudesandbeer.com. You can also find our episodes on Breach.tv, iHeartRadio, Spreaker, SoundCloud, iTunes, YouTube, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast service. Dudes and Beer is a proud member of the HC Universal Network family of podcasts. For more about our sponsors and other podcasts on this network, visit hcuniversalnetwork.com. Thanks for listening, everybody, and until next time, drink responsibly.